Well, I know many of you downtown for the rally, so we're going to get started right on time tonight. Actually, in all seriousness, if anyone here does need to leave early to go down to watch the presidential rally, just let me know. My only suggestion, though, is if you don't have tickets already, you're pretty much already cooked. You're not going to get a seat. So with that, we're going to push hard because I do need to end at 7:10, no later than 7:15 tonight, because I have a 7:30 engagement. So, announcements. One, I wanted to let everyone know, I've reminded you of this, I'll just keep reminding you of it. November 15th, keep the date open, State Bar of Texas Environmental Careers Panel. Prosecuting attorneys, civil enforcement attorneys, you're going to talk with NGOs, large law firm partners, small law firm partners at BP headquarters in the Energy Quarter. Chance to see their energy trading floor as well as their offshore wind energy control systems. Neat opportunity. So if you can, make sure it be in the afternoon. So save any time starting around 3 o'clock in the afternoon onward. Also, on the 16th of November, the refinery tour. So more on that as it develops. Just keep that Friday open. Last, Wednesday, you're going to have a guest speaker. Remember, we're going to have Chris Bell coming in to talk about the Toxic Substances Control Act, which is a very complicated area of the law that was overhauled extensively just a few years ago. Very few people know it well. Chris does. And I will also say that it's an area of law that has million or multi-billion dollar consequences in some cases. So it's a good thing to know for environmental law. And I'll be there sitting with you taking notes furiously because Chris is one of the best in the world at what he does. Those are my announcements. Do you guys have anything you want to bring to the attention of your classmates, colleagues, before we dive into finishing up hazardous waste today? You look like you can barely wait. Okay, so with that, tonight we're going to do two things. One, wrap up on the remaining from our discussion last week. Remember, we went through the definition of solid waste, the definition of hazardous waste, and some of the baseline requirements for generators, transporters, and operators of treatment storage disposal facilities. To do that wrap-up, I'm going to do a very quick reminder on the definitional issues with you. We're going to talk briefly about the City of Chicago versus EDF decision by Justice Scalia, because we ran out of time last week and didn't get to it. It's a rather surprising opinion. And then last, probably the most billable portion of this class you will have all semester, we'll talk about Dick Stoll's article on how to engineer the RCRA exemptions in creative ways so that you can help your client navigate compliance obligations. So since this portion of the class is substantive, I am recording it. So it will be available both in video as well as audio. However, I turn off both in about 20 minutes so we can do our class exercise. Remember, we are going to be doing a walkthrough of an enforcement proceeding. So to give you a quick heads up, I'm going to be asking you to be the company, all of you together. I'm going to be asking all of you guys to be the Department of Toxic Substances Control. Put it this way, I'll put all of you together. You're going to be both DTSC as well as the county. You're going to be the heavy hand of enforcement. And the idea here is I want to work through as your lawyer. Let me rephrase that. You're going to be my lawyers. I'm going to be the CEO of the company. Then I'm going to ask you to help me work through what sort of presentation we're going to make to the enforcement attorneys. And then I'm going to work through having them present it to you and see what sort of reactions you guys give to the arguments they want to make. And then we'll do a postmortem at the end. Okay? So any questions about that? All right. So with that, let's dive right in. Remember, last week we talked about how RCRA works. And the predicates were, remember, it has to be a solid waste. Solid waste is not easy. It can be liquid. It can be gaseous if contained. It can also fall within several different exemptions for materials that you might think would be solid waste, but actually are not. We'll talk about this exemption in a second. If it is solid waste, the next layer down is it can be a hazardous waste. And hazardous waste are defined by either characteristics, ignitable, corrosive, reactive, or toxic, or it's listed. And there are four different lists, but the bottom line is that listed chemicals, listed hazardous waste, are always hazardous waste when you use the mixture rule and mix them with other solid waste, or if you derive other things from them. There's also the contained in principle, which is our last multiplier rule. So does that all sound familiar to you? Okay? So with that in mind, remember? Well, that's the point of this example we went over last week. It's yours. I should warn you, I don't know when I bought that, but it's probably at least 2 or 3 years old, so eat that caution. But he's right. The generator designates the waste. You can be more protective if you think there's a gray area. You can call it hazardous, even if the agency may disagree with you. You, the generator, classify your waste at the point of generation. When you create it, that's when you have to say if it's solid waste or hazardous waste. You can't wait down the road or mix it with other things. It's right when you pull it out of the vat, pull out of the tank, when you pull out the furnace, that's the point of generation. Okay. Well, what was the point of this one? Mm-hmm. So what? You don't get to keep that. I wouldn't suggest keeping that. What's the point? Is it hazardous?
It is hazardous if the particulate that contain that has come from the already toxic or unoperable waste, right?
I literally could lick my finger, stick it in the jar, and swallow a big slug of it, and it wouldn't hurt me. Why do you think it's hazardous? What legal reasoning do you have here? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, Kyle. I didn't.
Just the answer.
Go for it. Would you like to assist? Go for it. Right. Remember, this is a listed hazardous sludge from a chemical plant's wastewater treatment plant. You burn it, filter cake it down, and this ash becomes basically an inert material, but it doesn't matter. It's derived from a listed hazardous waste, therefore is considered to be the same as that listed hazardous waste. Okay? But it's been since delisted. But here's the catch. Only for that facility. If Eastman has, the name of it's on there anyway. If Eastman has another chemical plant down the road, it doesn't matter. The listing only applies to that one facility. Chemically exactly the same, one's listed hazardous waste, the other isn't. All right. Any questions so far? Okay. Then a couple last ones. I didn't get a chance to show you this one. This is a sort of brain teaser for you. Here you go. What does it say on it? Say it loud. What does it say? Nanot, right? If you could pass that one back, because I'm not sure how long you want to hold on to it. That is a golf ball impregnated with carbon nanotubes. In theory, nanoscale carbon materials have high resiliency. If you hit them with a golf club, they go further. No one knows what this stuff does in the environment. But wow, was it like a meeting? Oh, okay. We're doing review, so this is pretty quick. Carbon nanotubes, if you soak them in water and expose them to sunlight, break down into a material that's as toxic as a commercial grade pesticide. Hazardous, solid, what is it? No.
Why not?
So you're okay if I throw it into the water hazard and it ends up dead fish floating on the top of the water in, say, 2 years, that's fine. Not hazardous.
I mean, it might be hazardous by a dictionary definition of it, but not
for. Jack's right. This stuff can kill you dead. Doesn't matter. If it doesn't meet the legal definition, it ain't hazardous. There's other stuff that I would happily swill down with a good beer. It's listed as hazardous waste, but it isn't actually physically harmful. Doesn't matter. It's the legal designation that matters. I've saved the trickiest one for last, and this revolves several concepts at the same time. I feel like that moment in The Matrix where he calls someone Copper Top. What?
It is a hazardous waste.
Why? Well, what do you have to show first before we get there?
Solid.
All right, so I'd have to throw it in the trash.
Okay, hold on a second. So it says a solid waste. When we say solid waste, not necessarily have to be, because the semi-liquid, the semi-solid also,
yeah, well, is
part of the solid waste.
Solid?
Correct.
Yeah, so the solid casing, the semi-liquid interior, those are all with physical conditioning that would qualify as solid waste. If, and here's the big if, the one that you bolded, underline your notes, I discard it. So, what happens if I don't discard it? What if I throw it into the recycling bin?
Okay, hold on. Another question. You or a company? Because
why does that matter?
Would that be a household?
All right, if I do it at home, what does it mean?
You can trash it.
Why?
Because you're exempt.
Exempt from what?
From discard household product.
Well, what does that exempt me from? There's a reason I'm asking. I'm not just being a pest. That's right. It's a household hazardous waste, which means it's still waste. That's the key thing. It's still solid waste. It's just not hazardous waste.
Okay.
Now, if it's not home, suppose that I'm throwing this away from, say, a large commercial installation. What else do we need to know? So what characteristics might apply? If I stomp on it, will it explode? Not reactive. If I put a blowtorch on it, will it burn? It might melt. It's not going to, so it's not ignitable. What about corrosive? Why? What pH does it have to be? I know, and that's probably too much in the weeds. I'm not going to expect you to know, but it has to be below 2.5 pH, which is pretty darn pH. It's above, I think it's above 10, but I'm going to be careful. It may be above 12.5. That's basic, extremely corrosive. Sorry, extremely. It's still corrosive, right? Thank you. I want to be sure. Okay, so is there anything else? Am I done? Any other waste codes to consider here? I doubt it'd be listed, wouldn't it? We're going to get to that at the end. That's the last thing after this point. Remember, in addition to being ignitable, corrosive, reactive, it can also be toxic. So we had to put it through, remember, the toxicity characteristic leaching procedure, TCLIP, which means we put it in a cage, we soak it in mild acid, we chop it up, we let it ferment, we pull the leachate off of it and see whether or not it has things like lead, benzene, other compounds. There's like a list of 40 constituents you test for. So if I chop this up, the odds are very high it's going to have metals to make it characteristically toxic. The nice thing about metals, if you burn them, they don't go away. They don't chemically break down. So if I burn these in a furnace, the metals just move to the ash. Keep that in mind when we get to our next case. All right, now to Jack's point. I wanted to say there is a coda here, and Jack's exactly correct. This is a nightmare. Can you imagine trying to decide which households have hazardous waste, which commercial facilities have to worry about hazardous waste, what sort of shipping requirements apply? So it turns out that there is a regulatory exemption for batteries and light bulbs. It's called universal waste, which basically has some notification paperwork tracking, but you're basically treated separately from the hazardous waste requirements. Key thing here is I just wanted to highlight you can recycle these and pull yourself out of the waste problem entirely. And you also have the possibility for it being multiple characteristics. So that helped bring everything back for you? Yes?
Is there anything with
I think there are, but the truth is those are the vast overwhelming majority of the ones people can use it for. I can check on that for you by next week, though, if you'd like. Okay, any others? All right, the a pure legal answer, under federal regulations, if there is a secondary material generated by another customer and then it is shipped off-site to someone else, the exemptions that would normally apply if you handle it on-site don't translate. So that usually has to get a TSDF, a full-fledged hazardous waste permit. However, now the real world answer. Under Texas regulations, if the same company owns both, even if they're physically separated, there's a geographic distance you can haul it and still not lose your exemptions. And also, EPA has tried to rewrite the definition of solid waste to exclude some recycled materials that are sent off-site. It's been tied up in litigation for multiple years. I think it's now emerged from the DC circuit, but we're still sort of figuring out how it actually applies. All right. Any others? Great questions. You guys are all destined to be RCRA lawyers, I can tell. Okay, so with that in mind, we now have the framework in place. We now know that generators, transporters, and treatment storage disposal facilities are the three categories you get folded into if you trigger the solid and hazardous waste requirements. So that brings us to our case, a rare Scalia opinion, which reaches a pro-environmental outcome. So with that in mind, who would like to, I know it was, sorry. I know that it was in our tail end of our last class, which was last week. But very quickly, does anyone want to sort of take a chance at running through it very fast? Because this is one where if no one raises their hand, I might actually just give you a quick Cliff Notes version. Okay, because I want to save time for our case example, our exercise. Okay, here's what's going on. One of the best ways you can get rid of trash is to burn it, but not to burn it for disposal, burn it for energy. So large municipalities frequently construct huge incinerators designed to capture the BTU value of the kind of household and industrial trash you might just see in a usual trash truck. The problem is, because of the household hazardous waste exemption, because there are other materials that may not qualify as hazardous, they still have enough residual toxics, you end up in a situation where, and I'll erase this diagram in a minute, you may have a stream going into the incinerator. The incinerator burns it, and you end up with two different waste streams coming out of it. One is a heavy bottom ash, sort of gritty. It looks like, almost, it's not like sand, it's like dirt, almost like pebbles in it. But then the finer stuff goes up the flue and is captured and is pulled out as fly ash. Here's the thing. If you have things like batteries or other types of metal-laden waste going in this end, even if it's household hazardous waste, the metals tend to accumulate in the fly ash. And if you run a T-clip test on it, the odds are pretty good. The majority of the time, it's going to flunk. On a straight-up, objective basis, it doesn't meet, it qualifies as a hazardous waste on the pure characteristic. So here's the question that City of Chicago versus EDF had to answer. What happens when this is exempt as household hazardous waste, but you still have this as a characteristically hazardous material coming from it? Remember, the derived from rule says that if this is hazardous, this is hazardous. Doesn't help us here, does it? The situation here is we have an exempt waste that's being burned to generate a characteristically hazardous waste. Does the exemption make it through the furnace? The City of Chicago said, hell yeah. If not, we're going to have to go through the RCRA nightmare of permitting this facility and treating all this ash, millions of pounds of ash, as hazardous waste. The Environmental Defense Fund said, whoa, now wait a minute. We have to look at the language of RCRA to answer this question. And RCRA didn't say that RCRA had a very specifically crafted exemption. Now here, if we had the time, I would gleefully torture one of you walking through the language bringing back fond memories of statutory interpretation and textualism and what was the intent of Congress and the debate between Stevens and Scalia. I think I can cut to the chase tonight because we have other fish to fry. The thing here is that the exemption, as written and as you see in your book on page 390, says, quote, a resource recovery facility, i.e. the thing that's burning the stuff, recovering energy from mass burning of municipal solid waste shall not be deemed to be treating, storing, or disposing, or otherwise managing hazardous waste, as long as it's only getting household hazardous waste, it's not mixing with other hazardous waste, and that their contracts verify that that's what it's doing, it's separating it, segregating it. Scalia's take was that language was unambiguous. This is a Chevron step one case, that rare mythical unicorn. He said basically that language didn't say the waste is exempt. Remember? It said the facility is exempt. And not only that, the language of the exemption is written, it's only exempt from having to get a treatment storage disposal facility permit. It doesn't have to be a large-scale hazardous waste management facility. What does that mean? It means there's still a generator for the waste, for the ash. And as we'll talk about to wrap things up in just a minute, there's a huge difference between being a TSDF and a generator. Remember, the TSDFs are the Death Stars of the RCRA universe. You have to get these incredibly complicated, very detailed, very expensive, very contentious permits to make sure that you are protecting the environment. A generator, on the other hand, very minimal requirements. You basically have to store the waste for less than 90 days, and you have to store it in certain kinds of tanks or containers that meet management standards, and get paperwork to track how you handle it. That's it. So if you have a choice, you are, from an industry perspective, far better off, bless you, to just be a generator. So Scalia's take was, the exemption here only comes up to the gate of the facility. The facility itself is only exempt from TSDF requirements, treatment storage disposal facility, but they still have to characterize the ash and declare themselves to be generators, which is what EDF wanted. That's protective. It means that the ash is being handled as a hazardous waste and not being magically blessed as an exempt material and shipped off to your standard trash landfill. Does that make sense for everybody? Now I tell you the secret story. Remember what I told you about generators? Jack, you could hold up your container of bad candy if you'd like. Who makes the call of what's the waste? The generator does. Here's the question. When does a generator have to do it? Do you remember I said? Sorry? Before what? Close. Very close. Matter of fact, I'd throw you more candy if I had it, but sadly I'm out of gimmies now. Point of generation. When you make the waste, you classify the waste. And you make the waste when you pull it out and start managing as a waste. What happens if I change my process so that instead of having this fly ash coming out the top, and this bottom ash coming out the bottom, and this fly ash is almost always hazardous for metals. This bottom ash is kind of occasionally, but not much. Instead, I set it up so that when I pull it out, they're both mixed together at the point of generation. Does that strike you as a potential solution, or does it strike you as a dodge? Why? I'm sorry, who said dodge? I wasn't watching. Chad? Sorry. Why? Well, the thing is, not only does the generator get to make the call on what's the waste at the point of generation, the generator designs the process. Remember, RCRA does not interfere with the production process. If you redesign it so it doesn't generate waste because it doesn't pull out the particularly vicious part of it. Instead, you have a bigger mass of less toxic waste. RCRA says that's okay. What you can't do is pull them out separately and then mix them in the middle of the night. But if it's coming out of the process as an integrated waste, environmentally, maybe we have some issues. Legally, it passes the RCRA. I almost said smell test, but it passes RCRA standards. Well, I'm not sure dilute's the right word. It's just that the way it's produced, it no longer contains a concentrated stream that would trigger the threshold. Dilution is a form of treatment which would require a permit.
So is this like a at any point in the process type thing? Does that make sense?
Well, whatever. So like, for example, instead of doing it here at the way it's burned, maybe you segregated the waste up here and pulled out the stuff that was particularly problematic with metals.
I guess my question more specifically is, although the standard is at point of generation, presumably there are points throughout the process of whatever they're doing mm-hmm. that it might meet characteristics and then go back down and then come back up, right? And my question is, if at any point in that process it meets the definition, do you sort of, it's like the switch turned on, or?
Now, that's a good question. Generally, it's up to the way the generator manages the material. So let's say I'm a refinery, and I'm managing petroleum, and I make a waste stream out of it, or side stream out of it, that still has some oil in it. Well, that could be a waste. I just get rid of it. Or I can route it back into the refining train. So that inflection point's driven by the generator. They get to choose how they manage it. It doesn't become a waste till they actually elect to handle it as a discarded material. That was the point of the API and the American Mining Congress case decision, because you have these kind of secondary materials that are in the process where they can send them back through to get more value out of them. So they're not waste yet, even though they look kind of like waste. But it's that decision point by the generator that discards it that makes the difference. Does that make sense for everyone? I'm sorry, she had her hand up first though. Interesting question. Let's say, for example, there wasn't a household hazardous waste exemption, that this was just good old garden variety industrial waste, and it was hazardous, and we knew it was hazardous going in. Well, then RCRA was triggered here, and this facility needs to get a TSDF permit, and this stuff generated by it is derived from. So you're absolutely correct. It can be a waste here, and it carries through. The point is, if it's not hazardous waste, but then you end up making something from it that has a characteristic, that exemption doesn't flow through in the language of RCRA. You have to look at this waste as if it's created anew. Right, it's not treating a hazardous waste when it burns it because it's exempt. But it does have to manage this as a generator of a brand new waste here. Does that make sense? Kevin, I'm sorry.
So just to clarify, going back and saying there's household waste that goes in, and they make the process before the point of generation, so it comes out and it doesn't meet a characteristic or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not hazardous waste. However, if they mix it afterwards and it doesn't meet it, that wouldn't be mixing because it's still mixed together and then loses the characteristic?
Well, if it's characteristic, and you mix it with another solid waste,
yeah,
and it loses the characteristic, it is not a hazardous waste anymore, but you need a waste permit to mix it. That's a form of treatment, so you're back into the TSDF universe. No, it's a very tricky point. A lot of people miss that, and a lot of people have to talk with their criminal defense lawyers at that point. And I'm not exaggerating. That's of all the RCRA violations, that's the one that leads to criminal violations most. The idea that you can dilute something to make the problem go away. Okay, any others? All right, so now you have a sense of how the Chinese puzzle box mentality works. I'm sorry, of course.
Okay, so to understand a little bit of the generator, they determine the way, if it's going to pass according to standards, right?
Mm-hmm. Well,
how they dispose of?
Right. The way it usually works, if we were running a chemical plant together or a small manufacturing plant and we generate a waste, usually what happens is we store it while we figure out what to do with it. So we have up to 90 days as a generator to store the waste on site without having to get a full big permit. Side note, if it's a really tiny amount of waste, you can have more time, 180 days, sometimes even more for really small amounts, but generally 90 days is the magic number. Now, at that point, we have to get a transporter to come to our site, or have our own transporter that we hired, that we employ. But nonetheless, you have to get a transporter to get the material. We give them a manifest, which is basically a tracking document, and then it goes to someone else to be managed for disposal purposes. So of the universe, 80 to 90% of the waste, the RCRA parties are generators, but they have a light footprint. The transporters are a small number too, but they are the life, they're sort of the veins and the arteries of the system that convey it to where it goes. And then there's a small number of large facilities that handle disproportionate amounts of the material for actual treatment, storage, and disposal of the materials. Save that question. Yes, is the short answer. If you give your waste to someone who's a transporter, and that transporter hauls it and pours it into the kiddie's swimming pool at the nearby municipal swimming pool, you are ultimately responsible for the way your waste was mismanaged, even if you directed them not to do it. It's strict liability. In addition, under Superfund, our next statute, you're separately liable for cleanup costs associated with that. So the bottom line is you just make really, really sure that whoever you hire to haul your waste around does what they say, and you track to make sure they do it the right way.
So even if you comply with all of the use of the manifest system, mark and label the shipment, comply with the EPA, Department of Transportation regulation, you're still going to be liable until it reaches the final destination.
I personally have stood in warehouses filled with drums with my client's label on the side, that the client showed me the paperwork, said they were supposed to be in a different state entirely, and it didn't matter. EPA wanted them to come and clean it up and haul them away. Is that the answer?
Yeah.
Okay. It's not fair, but it's not meant to be. It's meant to make sure the environment's protected, and the presumption is that the people who make the waste have the moral and ethical and legal responsibility to handle the consequences of the waste, even if someone else screws it up. There are some exceptions we can talk about, like act of God, or act of third parties, act of war, but generally they're very rarely available. Okay, any others? Okay, so briefly, Dick Stoll's article, and I'm worried we're gonna not have as much time for our negotiation exercise, so I'll try and be brief with this. I strongly urge you to take a little time to read through it, not because I'm going to ask you to duplicate these brain teasers in the final exam. This is the sort of stuff that if I were presented with a question like this, I would actually pull the regulations off the shelf, and I'd be very careful to go through them directly. I wouldn't just try them off the top of my head. They're very tricky. What I want you to do is get a flavor. This is what RCRA practice is really like. The clients will come to you, and they have essentially a waste issue, and they have regulations that to the normal human being are impenetrably complex. And your mission is to either tell them, look, there is no answer, you gotta do X the way EPA likes, or you see whether or not the pieces can be fit in such a way that are still smart and environmentally protective, but don't trigger some regulatory burdens that may not be required in this situation. But generally what that means is that you start packaging exemptions. You start stitching together different exceptions from the definitions. So the ones that you typically see most, as always, definition of solid waste. The definition of solid waste has exceptions built into it that we've talked about. In particular, the most important ones are discharges from point sources with NPDES permits. Another one that's very important is you get an exception for certain types of reclaimed materials. And you also have an exception for domestic sewage. All right, so what? You also get exceptions to the definition of hazardous waste. We've talked about some of them. Just for the starters, household hazardous waste, but there are others as well. Here's where you start getting other ones, though. These are the two I'd fold into the mix that make this complicated. One is for tank systems. If I have hazardous waste that's contained in a tank, and this tank system includes pipes, and the pipe goes to an outfall, that means for my facility, everything that's in that tank system up to the point of discharge is not required to have a permit. The other thing is once it's discharged, it ain't a hazardous waste in a RCRA anymore, or solid waste anymore. So that essentially means that you make sure if you're handling liquid, water, waste kinds of hazardous waste, and it's in a tank system, you make sure it meets the EPA requirements where that tank must, for example, it can't leak. It has to meet certain operational requirements. So this means, for example, large-scale underground sewer systems and refineries, wastewater collection systems, aren't giant wastewater treatment plants. The other one is the recycling process. And just for future reference, if you want it, 40 CFR 261.6. What does that mean? It means that recycling a material is not disposing of it. The process itself is not required to get a TSDF permit. If I have a facility and it generates a material that I want to recycle to either reuse it again or to get something valuable out of it, and I take it and I recycle it in a tank and I put it straight into the tank. I don't store it first. I don't do anything else to it. This recycling process in the tank is exempt. So basically, that tank, that container, that vat is not a RCRA waste management unit. So imagine when you start combining point source discharges with a recycling process unit that's connected to a tank system, you can see that you can actually stitch together fairly comprehensive systems to deal with waste at a facility. The important thing is that each of these have separate requirements that you have to meet. And these requirements, in theory, keep the whole thing environmentally protective. So I will pause here. I know that this is, I think I'll be honest with you, this is a point where I have a lot of students every year who kind of say, that doesn't really sound right. But I assure you, A, if it's done right by people in good faith, it's usually protective. B, if you screw it up, the consequences are pretty severe, so people take it very seriously. And C, the truth is, this is a lot of what hazardous waste legal practice is like, is thinking about how to navigate the regulations and apply to particular facilities. So with that, I'll take a pause. Is any questions about that? You have to notify EPA or the state that you're a generator. You don't need a permit to be a generator.
No.
Now, basically, it's a notification process. So you register as a generator or get a generator waste. You get what's called a generator ID number. And that's how they keep track of you. But you don't have like a giant permit like you do with a TSDF.
So the point of these exemptions is to get out of the TSD process and not necessarily not be flagged as a generator.
Most facilities are happy to be generators and tell EPA exactly what they're doing and manifest all their waste. They just don't want to be a TSDF. And very briefly, why? You have to show financial assurance that any kind of contamination you'll clean up, even if it be 30 to 100 years in the future. You have to have what's called a corrective action plan. So if there's contamination on your 100-acre facility from someone who operated there 100 years ago, as part of your quid pro quo for getting a permit, you've got to go clean up the historical contamination from solid waste units. So, you know, their facilities not to tell war stories, but for example, some go back to 1900, like Kodak had giant chemical facilities up in Rochester. They're just all sorts of amazing contamination there that they didn't actually, the people who are running it now had nothing to do with, but as part of getting a RCRA permit, they'd have to go out and actually characterize and clean up all that waste too. There are lots of other reasons, but those are the two big ones. Okay. Any others? All right. Well, then with that, I'm going to take a deep breath. If you have any questions, I'll save some time at the start of next week's class on Monday to just sort of give you a last parting look at RCRA before we move on to Superfund, which is even more fun. But for now, what I would suggest is take a look at Dick Stoll's article, make sure you have a feel for how it stitches together, and perhaps we could talk about that a little bit more on next Monday. Okay. I am now. Oh, I'm sorry, is there someone online? Safe? Well, if I hate to say this, if there's anyone online, you're being disconnected now, because this is the negotiation portion of the class, and I promised that we were not going to be recording this portion so people could play their roles with gusto. All right. Bear with me here. There we go. And let me sign out, and we are ready to roll.